As the defense wraps up its case, it took jurors on a broad sweep of travel today as it ties up loose ends. We've been to Kazakhstan, the Supermax prison in Colorado, and on a tour of the adolescent brain. It's day 28, and from the Moakley Federal Courthouse in Boston, this is Finish Line inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Kevin, I was thinking, what a great day for adult education today. We have been everywhere.
Yes. It started off as a National Geographic special. Then it became Nova.
Then it ended. Where in the world is Carmen San Diego?
And then we saw Wilfred Brimley.
Wilfred Brimley. We have to start with that because, in fact, we had the defense calling forward a guy from the Federal Bureau of Prisons. He's been there 28 years. His last stint as a warden was at Terre Haute, which means he was the warden of death row. He is a witness for the defense. He is a dead ringer for Will Brimley.
I was waiting for him to say diabetes. His name is Mark Beasy. He looked like an old sheriff. Turns out he was an old warden. And it's funny, David, because throughout this trial, whenever the prosecution could show a photograph of Jahar Tsarnaev in front of a black Islamic flag, sometimes used by Islamic groups, they did. It just appeared out of nowhere. Yeah. And today we saw, for at least the third or fourth time by my count, an aerial picture of the ADX, the Supermax prison, the highest security prison in the United States in Colorado. And the defense keeps showing that up there. They are basically advertising to the jury, this is what you can sentence him for. I actually thought this was getting down to the essence of the penalty phase, because it's down to, are you going to kill him or are you going to put him in the worst prison in America?
Well, this is the worst case scenario for the defense. If they don't buy the other arguments, right, here is one where you'll be making him suffer for the rest of his life. That's why when they show that photo of ADX, of the Supermax prison, they never show it in the springtime. It's in winter, and it looks like Siberia. Beasy was a very effective witness, I thought, for the defense. He knows his stuff, and he knows it cold. Single cell, solitary, 23 hours a day, no communications with anybody but immediate family members, and only on approval from the attorney general upon recommendations from the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston. They made that clear. In other words, you think this U.S. attorney, this FBI, is going to recommend that this guy not be on special administrative protection?
Right. He's putting it right back on the government, saying that it was up to the government to make this thing happen. There are 34 cells for people that are under these, what they call SAMs, under these highly restrictive restrictions. And that there are 27 cells occupied right now, meaning if you do the math, there are seven. There's
vacancies.
No waiting. Just send us here. He can move right in. It was pretty obvious.
And these are 27 people, and they are terrorists. They go there as terrorists. Again, Beasy is asked about communications. 1 15-minute phone call a month, unless it's to, but only to immediate family members. It is recorded. It's analyzed, mail only from family members, only when approved. And then the question that Bruck thought was important for this witness, and what about contact to the media?
None.
What about contact from the media?
None. It's very important for the defense to get this through, because I think the defense knows in its heart that whatever comes out of this jury is not necessarily going to be coming from a place of mercy. It's going to be, what do you think is the worst punishment for this kid? Putting him on death row where he'll probably linger for how many years and we'll go through this, you know, there'll be appeals and appeals and whatever. Or putting him in a place where there's really no pretense of rehabilitation. That the Supermax prison is about punishment and he will be punished. He won't be able to be a famous jihadi. He won't be embraced by any because he can't communicate with anybody. In my opinion, David, throughout this whole penalty phase, I thought Mark Beasy was the most effective defense witness so far.
And it was interesting how much the defense spent with him. This tells me they are close to the end, this is the last argument, really. What we've also seen, Kevin, is where the prosecution thinks the argument is particularly persuasive. They demonstrate it with either the aggressiveness or snide remarks.
I thought Steve Mellon he got up with this sense of urgency in his voice. And remember, Steve Mellon is a journeyman for the Justice Department. This is what he does. He does death penalty cases. Now, he knows as much about the ADX as Mark Beasy. He really does know a lot about it. And I could tell the way he reacted, he knew this is something getting to the jury. We could be losing the jury right at this moment.
So let's move on because we got a lot to cover. We start in Kazakhstan this morning. That's an interesting procedure.
We didn't see that coming. The first witness today happened to be by video. And actually, it began with Bill Weinreb, the prosecutor, getting up and asking the jury be instructed that this is not under oath. They go through the pretense of this being under oath. But while he is sworn in under oath here in Boston by video link, he's in a foreign country, and basically it doesn't count.
Yeah, he's in Almaty, Kazakhstan, the biggest city there. First of all, he was married to one of Zhar's sisters, Ailina, and also his sister is married to one of the Tsarnaev brothers, so to
Ruslan.
Ruslan.
Well, people probably remember the one uncle right after the bombing, he got up and he pronounced his nephews as losers. Uncle Ruslan is actually the most successful member of the Tsarnaev family, and he's the one that had a house out in Washington State that this kid came and actually studied at and met Alina Tsarnaev, and they ended up marrying when he was 20 and she was 16.
Almirza Kozagov has a viewpoint because he's friendly with Tamerlan, he's close to the family, he's visited Cambridge, and he sees them out there in Washington State where he was going to school. And for the first time, Kevin, we're going back to points that the defense has been making, but it now seems to clarify the meltdown of the Tsarnaev family in Cambridge, where Anzor and Zubedat, father and mother, are fighting with each other. He says neither of them wanted to give in, so they had a lot of conflicts, and Zubedat had more authority than the father did. Then we have those medical records being read into the record about Anzor, who we now know has been treated for psychosis, for mental illness.
Right.
He's been diagnosed as suffering from PTSD. He had said that he was in a concentration camp during the first Russian Grozny War, and that's what was one of the atrocities of the war. May 2006, symptoms returned. Panic attacks. Then come the return of the voices. Flashbacks. 2009, he says there are voices screaming his name or whispering it. Visual hallucinations and suddenly little lizard-like creatures that he's seeing. That's compounded by being in a bar fight in which he takes a beating. That leaves him with a fractured skull.
Yeah.
Then he comes back and he says, if I'm not getting better, my wife will divorce me. He tells the doctors that. A year later, the doctor writes Anzor is suffering from mental illness. He's not gotten better. And we now know that he and his wife are divorced. And then during the same period of time, Almirza Kozagov witnesses the changes in Zubedat, the mother, and Tamerlan. He returns to Kazakhstan. Suddenly, Zubedat, the mother, shows up at the airport. She's completely covered. He says, to be honest, it made me laugh. I knew that wearing those clothes isn't going to change her.
Right.
Then we find out about Tamerlan, his once close friend, and this guy, Misha.
Misha is introduced as that's the radicalizer. That's, you know, when they talked earlier during the guilt phase, David, they were talking about the idea of whether you could be radicalized just online. And there's always that one person that needs to push you over. And it sounds like Misha, by this account, was that person. This guy talked about he was surprised all of a sudden that Tamerlan, who was quite an accomplished boxer, stopped boxing. And he said he stopped boxing because Misha told him in Islam, it's not right to hit somebody in the head.
And it's not right to listen to music, so you stop playing the piano. And he also was an aspiring actor. Misha said, no, in Islam, we don't do acting either.
This is the point of the radicalization in which Tamerlan just went fully over. And you could tell by the way this guy testified, he was genuinely surprised. He didn't see it coming. And as he said, that discussion of religion and politics always made him uncomfortable.
So he sees Tamerlan go over the edge, he would say, Zubedat go over the edge, and there's Zhar, the boy. This is the defense case, looking up to the older brother.
Yeah.
That's the case.
We know that Zhar, there have been witnesses introduced that he was very good with babies and dogs. And today we heard he was actually a chaperone for kids with special needs to a prom. So that was the trifecta, the final one. So he's good with babies, he's good with dogs, and he's good with kids with special needs.
Wow.
The defense has introduced all those things to say that this is somebody who should be saved from the death penalty because there was a decency to him. Before he walked down Boylston Street with that bag, this is the kind of kid he was.
Okay, so quickly, let's talk about the adolescent brain. the immaturity of the adolescent brain. We went there, too, today with a guy named Dr. Geed, the defense witness, talking about the human brain and the brain maturation process.
I guess you could say he was a much-anticipated defense witness, because we thought this was going to be a huge part of the defense case. To give that sort of reasonable doubt to the jurors, don't sentence this kid to death if you think there's something that the maturation of his brain wasn't there. But I have to tell you, David, after listening to this guy testify, I thought he was as good, if not better, for the prosecution.
He talks about hormone-fueled limbic system. That's the system connected to desires, to passion, hunger, sleep, the emotional drive. And then he talks about the prefrontal cortex, which is associated with such things as impulse control. And then he shows us the imaging of the brain. And what he's trying to say is that the brain does not fully mature until some point down the line, which is well past adolescence.
Well, that the age they kept throwing out there was 25. They wanted you to believe that it's between 25 and 30, but it's at least 25 where the brain finally matures, and that's on average. And I thought in her cross-examination, Nadine Pellegrini for the prosecution just scored, and she was actually, unlike Mellon, who I thought was super aggressive, Nadine almost was surprised how easy this was going.
The same person who was so snide during a cross-examination of Catherine Russell's roommate yesterday suddenly is very pleasant because
very nice.
The witness is so accommodating, and he's agreeing with her. And she says, well, isn't it behavior instead of looking, imaging brains? Isn't it just looking at people's behavior themselves? And then he says, yes. And then she says, people who aren't in your field can also look at behavior, personal behavior, and determine whether it's mature or immature. They don't need imaging, do they? And he says, no, they don't. He agrees with her. We go to the behavior. That's the gold standard.
When he uses behavior as the gold standard, he sounded like a prosecution witness. But I also think it actually kind of exposed the sort of the ultimate contradiction that the defense is in. They have put witness after witness during this phase showing that Jahar was a decent young man and that he was actually, in respect, they were saying he was mature beyond his needs. He was nice to people. That's not suggesting somebody that's immature. It's suggesting just the opposite. And I think this defense witness, to me, I actually thought, in the end, he did more credit to the prosecution than the defense.
What I don't understand is why they didn't bring in one of the psychiatrists with the American Psychiatric Association. They were the ones that had prepared the brief that the Supreme Court looked at, and it convinced the Supreme Court to prohibit the death penalty for people who are mentally ill and for people who are juveniles below the age of 18. I'm stunned that they didn't want to get this on the record, because the Supreme Court's ruling basically recognized a couple of things. One, juveniles are less mature and responsible than adults, and therefore more likely to engage in impetuous and poorly thought out actions. Secondly, the juveniles are more vulnerable and susceptible to negative influences such as peer pressure. These were key points. It would have advanced the defense argument, in my opinion. Of course, the problem is they have ruled that for people under 18, but they still could have argued this is what the science is telling us.
I think really the main reason that Dr. Geed was up there is that age of 25, that's what they wanted to focus on. They wanted people to believe that, hey, this guy was 5 years away from the average maturation process of a human brain. And, you know, I think they got it out there.
Well, I'm exhausted. It's been a long day, and it's the end of day 28. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
We'll be back tomorrow.
Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at BostonGlobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.